had another sister called Mary, which worked for another Mr. Powell, in the building itself, in Stone House. My sister Mary decided to go back to Bristol for some reason, to my grandmother. And then a few weeks later, my mother decided to get also to go back to Bristol. So I had to go too. I was sorry to leave the farm. But on the way back to Bristol, walking the roads, of course, walking our way back, we stopped in a lodging house. And in those days, lodging houses, a man could stop for 9 pence a night, or a whole family for 2 and 6 months. And whilst we were there, there was a radio SOS for our family. My sister had been burnt to death in Bristol. There was a fire at my grandmother's house, and she had died, my sister. On return to Bristol, we went to live with my grandmother, which was still alive, of course. And then I went to work again at the age of 12 years old in an ironmonger's shop for Mr. Tapper, Westbury-on-Trim. I had very little education, as you can understand. The first education I ever received was after joining the army in 1938, when I decided then that I must learn something. I went to school then and received a third certificate in the army, which is not very much, of course. But I went to school after working hours, so I could learn a little bit more. Whilst I was working for Mr. Tapp at the ironmongers, I was found out by the labour exchange because they wanted to know why I never had no cards. They had cards in those days, the same as today. My mother also came into work. She used to receive 5 shillings a week, and I used to receive 3 shillings a week, which was 8 shillings a week. It was quite a bit of money. Well, it helped out quite a lot. This is a hard story, it must be, when I think back on it, because my mother stood at the bottom of Park Street, Bristol, selling matches. Can you imagine it? She would do anything for a few shillings. I think she came from a gypsy family. I have no real proof of this, but things that happened in the past make me think this very much. My things were bad for everyone in those days. But when the Employment Bureau found me out, I had to leave. And the only thing I could do then was part-time work. So I got a job delivering papers. An old paper man that used to stand at the top of Wine Street, Bristol, as it was in those days. He lived at Southmead. I can't remember his name, but he was established with the Evening Post, as we called it at that time. I remember he used to get a farthing in the penny for all the papers he sold. And the papers were a penny each at that time. He used to give me a penny a night to deliver his papers around the local shops and offices, and a few walnuts. He loved nuts. There used to be a fruit shop at the bottom of Union Street. And in there they used to give him nuts and fruit every night, or whenever they had it to spare. And he was always chewing nuts. And he used to give me a few as well. There aren't people who will remember him, I suppose. My old grandfather used to be on the docks. He was known as Tommy the Liar. Always sat on the top of the, by Bristol Bridge, by the old tracer sheds. That's the sheds, which are there still today, I think, where the tracer horses used to walk up Baldwin Street to Bristol Bridge, up the incline, out the old brewery wagons up, and the GWR wagons, when they were loaded, and two horses could not pull them up the hill, the two tracer horses would hook up to them, pull them over the hill, and come back to the stables and wait. My grandfather used to always on that dock from 6 in the morning to about 9 at night. He used to watch boats or direct traffic, anything at all to get a penny or two. And he looked after my grandmother well. My grandmother wasn't a very nice old lady. I didn't think so anyway. She drank a lot and screamed a lot and sat at home a lot, and left my old grandfather Tommy to do all the hard work and look after him. He was blind in one eye. I forget what the story goes now. He also had a little bump on his head. A nottage bump, we called it. He was a good chap. I liked him very much. Now I've started the story, I've made my mind not to stop. It'd get a bit mixed up at times, but I'm sure a writer will sort it out. And my main object is some money for my old age. From when I was 16 onwards, everywhere I went, everything I'd done, everyone believed me to be 17. So I went to work at 16 for a firm called Carwood Dines, which were in production today, and passed my driving test with them. Of course, they thought I was 17. I went in the army at 17, and of course they thought I was 18. I went in the army in the 1938 crisis, and that's when I really began to live, because they clothed me, they fed me, and they paid me, and in return I accepted the discipline. I became a good soldier, a first-class shot. And until I completed my initial training, in my opinion, and my report, I was a first-class soldier. And then I arrived at my battalion, I told the shot, in time to go abroad for the war breaking out in 1939. I went to France. I was taken prisoner at Dunkirk. May I stop to add that originally I joined the Territorial Army at 16, the 6th Gloucesters. And 10 years later, I finished my service with the Gloucesters, 1st Battalion, in Korea. As from then on, at the Indian Battle, we were known as the Glorious Gloucesters, for which I have now in my possession the American citation presented to us in Korea by General Van Fleet for our heroic stand at the MGM battle and held off the Chinese voluntary forces to allow the American 8th Army to evacuate successfully. I have that citation of honor today, which is held by very few in this country. Of the original clusters, I would say about 150 in Korea. There was also a mortar battalion, I think it was a 44th or a 40th mortar battalion, which would only be about 100 odd men, to ever receive the American citation of honor. For honor, of course. A bit there from 1938 to 1950-51. Stop. Back to PEF, France. I was taken prisoner at Dunkirk after doing a rearguard action. At this time I was with the Warwickshire Regiment, Royal Warwickshire Regiment, which holds some good memories for me and some good friends, and some sad ones of course, because I lost a lot of good friends in this regiment. We done a rear guard at a place called Wormholt, 8 kilometres from Dunkirk, and I'm afraid that was the end of the battalion. Within 12 hours of being taken prisoner, myself and a friend of mine called Miles tried to escape, but it was very unsuccessful, and within the 12 hours we were taken prisoner again. We were marched about 50 miles into France, then put on cattle trucks and taken to Germany. Our first stop was at a place called Trieste, and overnight we slept out at this place, and we were bombed by the British. This we didn't mind, because it's just one of those things. I wish I'd have bombed plenty more that time. The next day we were put on cattle trucks again and taken from France, travelling about days and days, I don't know how long, I can't remember, I think about 7 days. I know it's a shorter journey than that, but it took 7 days by cattle truck to Silesia on the Polish border. This is where we began to get ill and hungry. I remember first chaps that had dysentery on this trip, and there was no means getting out of the trucks. We were packed in like sardines, and when men had dysentery, we had to hold them up to a little grill in the side of the cattle truck, high up on the wall, with about 6 bars or something like that. And they would pull on their pants and put their bottom to the bars and do the necessary. Well, with dysentery, it's obvious. It was not solid matter. It would blow back into the truck and cover everyone else. Well, what could we do? Urinate. You know, to urinate, they would just do it in the corner. It would run along the floor, and everyone would get wet, of course. These are the things, horrible things, but we, in those times, we accepted them, we had to. When we arrived at the other end of the journey, at a place called Lambsdorff, Starlight 8B, later called 344, it was a big camp, finally built to house 80,000 prisoners or troops. And at times it was full of prisoners, I can assure you. This was a terrible place, really. We only had one meal a day, which was a cup of coffee, a piece of bread, and a bowl of watery soup. The men used to have to go down to the kitchen, or half a mile away, and carry back the potatoes, boiled in their jackets, for the old compound, which would weigh 200-400 away. And you would get 3 or 4 men each side of the box to carry the potatoes. And I will never forget. This always reminds me of men carrying a coffin, the bearers. Men were hungry and starving. And when our men are like that and desperate, they would do anything. And they would have one arm supporting the box, the coffin, and the other arm would be sliding over the top to try and pinch one potato. But if the guards saw them, they would hit them with the butts of their rifles, or even shoot them. And when you got to your compound, a senior NCO or warrant officer would issue the food out. And as you can understand, at times, not always, because they were decent and respectable NCOs, warrant officers, some would see their mates had a little bit more, and themselves a little bit more. But some are not as strong as others, and this sort of thing goes on. There are hundreds of stories to be told like this. I'll probably tell you 50% of them in the course of this story. I don't know what I get through, really. I've seen men, when they're hungry, fight almost to death for the grouts, mind you, of coffee. When we all went through and had our ladle of coffee, what was left in the bottom, the grouts, which was a substitute for coffee, burnt barley. The men would go back for the grouts, either to smoke or to eat. And if one pushed in front of the other, they would fight like dogs. I suppose I shouldn't remember all these things, I should forget. At times I do, other times they fled back, and this is one of the times. When we arrived at Lambsdorff, we were all to be registered, have our photo taken, with all our hair cut off, and by this time we were hungry and thin and dejected looking. Everyone had to have their number plate put across their chest and their photo taken. And at one time I saw this picture at a later date, and I looked a pity in sight. I could draw that picture now with no bother at all. Every time you left the camp for a working party, they would produce this identity card with your picture on to see if it was you. Sometimes the guards would give you the card to hold until you arrived at the desk for identification. And at one time I received this card with the picture on. And it's a picture still imprinted in my memory now. My first working party was a place called Reisenberg, small village on the River Oder, East Germany, Polish border. And we had to dig a overflow through the banks and a canal leading down to the river. This was getting cold now, and we had to dig this canal by hand and up to our knees or waist in water. And we received 2 slices of bread a day on the job and a bowl of soup at night when we arrived back to our billet. This was a party of about 30 men, and we were building a guest house. The guest house family had a son and a daughter, teenagers. And we were put in a big room above the guest house to sleep on mattresses on the floor. And every night, the teenagers had to go through our room, which was disgusting. Men were naked, no clothes, filthy, dirty, lousy, to go to their bedroom. No one ever molested them or talked to them or bothered with them, but we used to think how revolting for these 2 children. And then they would have to lock their door on the other end. At night, we all had dysentery, and they would put a big bucket in the room for our waste matter. When we were seriously bad, 30 men would fill this bucket, and it would be brimming over the top. It had to be carried down the stairs, the guest house, out the back, to the toilet, which was just a cesspit at that time. One man volunteered for a little bit of extra food. He would do this. We can always get someone to do this sort of thing. Stop. When this job was finished, our working party moved about 3 miles down the road to a place called Heidelberg. From there, we used to do every sort of job. Still on the River Oder, so we unloaded stone bodies from the road mending, snow shifting in the local roads. I will remember this. By this time it was winter, of course. And we had to unload coal barges on the River Oder for the local villages. Although the River Oder is the fastest flowing river in eastern Germany or Europe, the ice froze very thick, and the convoys of traffic used the ice river instead of the bridges, because the bridges were few and far between. But whilst we were unloading these stone barges, these coal barges, we had to keep them free of ice so that they would come up with the emptying of them. We had to stand on the ice on the river with ice picks and cut the barges around and around and around so we could keep them free so that they would come up as the other fellows were unloading them, so they would not split in half. This was very cold. I would say at times at this point 20, 30 below. And when I worked in Poland later, it was 40 below. when the ice froze on your eyebrows, on your moustache, your lips, or whatever you had, and all around your collar where your hot breath went, on your coat and your clothes was thick ice and frost, with your heat, the heat of your breath freezing, and your boots froze stiff on your feet, and it was impossible to take your hands out of your pockets or to work without any gloves whatsoever, otherwise your fingers were frostbitten, and it was serious. At Heidelberg, a village again of course, there is a city called Heidelberg somewhere in Germany, but this was a village. At night, the lights used to go at 10:30 at night. Half past 8 at night. And one man had to get up to the windows and roll out the blackouts every night to let a bit of light in, you see. But we had no clothes, no pajamas, of course, not even pants or vest to wear by this time. As a matter of fact, my last shirt I had, I went to the toilet with dysentery, and it was in rags around me. I used to tuck my shirt up my back like we all do, of course, even today. But it fell down and got mixed up with the dysentery, so all I did was pull the threads, and away it fell into the old cesspit. Now back to the blackouts. One man had to roll the blinds every night. When the lights went out, he'd climb up to the window. He was usually stark naked, and he would roll the blinds. But the village children got to know this, and they would wait until we were rolling the blinds, till the lights went out, and would flash torchlights on the window and get a pretty picture. As you can imagine, there was a young girl opposite the billet which kind of took a fancy to me. That was all. I never even spoke to the girl. This is gospel. But she liked me for some reason. She must have been 13 or 14 years old, and I was 19. I was still a young soldier, and if I was fed and smartened up, I would have probably looked smart. And she used to send me a couple of eggs or a piece of cake with a little brother and push through the wires. He still had wire around, even on these working parties, of course. Now, this young boy, he gave me a little photo of himself and his sister. He was about 10 and she was about 13. And his name was Gunter Galita. And her name was Isle Galita. And of course, if they were alive today, she would be about 45. And the boy would be about, well, 44 or something like that. That's, I never spoke to the girl, but I had her cake and I had her eggs. From here into a place called Godalming, cement works. And it was still winter and very cold indeed. And it was sleet and ice coming down, freezing on the stones in the quarry of the ice work, of the cement works. And we all refused to work, about 100 men. The guards turned out and got us all back to work, but 3. Myself, a chap called Chippy Woods from London. I've never met him since. A chap called Joe Stead from Shepton Mallet, which I contacted just a few years ago, but he's still alive, but a sick man. We didn't go back to work, us three. And the guard said, if you don't work, we'll shoot you. And we were desperate, and we said, well, shoot us. So they put us against the wall, facing the wall, lined the guards, took aim, relaxed, took aim, relaxed. And the guard commander said, well, these chaps are serious. So that's it.